Even doing?
Worrying.
You're adjusting the volume of the headphones.
I'm worrying about
which
everything.
Which makes no impact.
I'm worrying about
on the program.
I'm worrying about loud noises.
We're good. It's fine.
I always worry about loud noises as I'm looking at the little thing over there.
Yeah.
This is an ongoing concern of mine, loud noises.
Well,
Good loud noises that should not be happening.
Okay, well, if you ever want to learn how to produce this podcast,
that's not what I want.
You can observe firsthand.
I don't want that. I want
relax, Louise. Is what I'm saying.
I'm going to relax and become really chill so that I can co-host this podcast of the cinema.
Thank you.
That's Linoleum Knife is a podcast of the cinema.
Yes.
One of your hosts is me. My name is Dave White. I am a film critic for linoleum-knife.com.
You are.
Put that dash
the dash
in the
is essential.
You are.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm film reviews editor at The Wrap and a film critic for What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube. And joining us today is our very good friend and the host of The Joel Ryan Thing, a podcast about teen idols, child stars, and other human beings. Please welcome Joel Ryan.
Woo! Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's fun to see this magic, like, in person.
I'm not hearing your voice in my headphones, Joel.
I can speak closer to the mic.
Does she need to be turned up?
I've got her up, but you know, I'll go even a little further up because we have big belly diaphragms.
I sound like everything in my head, and
that's how you live your life.
I want everybody else to sound that way.
So, Joel, welcome to the program.
Indeed, welcome. Thank you for the ponchicks.
Yes. Let's talk about stuffed Armenian donut holes, which are amazing.
I thought I would bring a taste of Glendale.
Some have custard in them, and some have Nutella in them.
And they are both delicious.
They're really good. I don't know that I knew these even existed. How did I not know these existed?
Our personal Armenians have been holding out on us.
Yeah, what's up? I have like half a dozen Armenian pals in my life.
They have not been forthcoming.
And they're not casual. These are not casual Armenians.
No.
In my life.
These are tight
Armenian bros in my life who've never put one ponchik in my mouth. Then you guys know who you are, and you're listening, probably.
It's perhaps I've blown the cover, so maybe it was supposed to be like a special Glendale secret.
We would have gone to Glendale to get them.
Glendale ain't that far away from us. It's a short hop over the hill and on the 134.
I'll be going
there for some ponchiks.
I was just in Glendale. I went to the board game cafe is in Glendale.
Oh, yes.
Which I love. You been?
It is fantastic. It's so crowded now, you actually need like reservations.
Crazy.
To get there. Yeah, it's
my
crazy.
Pushy dentist used to be in Glendale.
I am.
I quit going to him. I quit him.
He was pushy.
He was just super pushy and would start talking to you about the bill in the dentist chair.
Whoa.
I was like, dude, you need to calm down.
He was always upgrading with you. He was very, do you want fries with that?
Yeah.
As far as like the dental services go.
I learned but here's the other thing. I learned more about Armenians in that dentist office than I learned from, again, any of my Armenian friends who have yet to give me any ponchiks. He had a magazine in his waiting room that was all about Armenians. It was an all-Armenian magazine.
Did it have, like, the Armenian power list or something?
It did. It had the Armenian power list. They had the annual power list, and they listed the most powerful Armenians. Now, this was a good dozen years ago.
Where was Cher on this list?
So Cher was number two
on
this list.
Really?
Number one was some industrial titan who had an eye patch.
Ooh, well.
A man who is not a celebrity. Now, obviously, we all know now who the number one Armenian is in the whole world. But
oh, true.
But this was before her.
Yes.
She was still young.
There was a time before
she had not yet met Ray J.
Right.
And there was not her yet.
Yes.
But
okay, this is fascinating.
Fascinating magazine.
Can we talk to Joelle about her show?
We're
going to
do that. We're going to do that right now.
Now, you are a long-standing expert in the child star biz, and which is, I think it's cool that you have, it's sort of like me in Christmas movies. You found this underloved area of pop culture that people are interested in, but that nobody was willing to step up and be the expert on.
Right. There's probably a reason, because I'm maybe not many people are really seriously that interested in it. So it's perhaps that's why it was there.
Now, we met when you made a film called Former Child Star.
Yes.
It's a very funny comedy about an aging young adult actress who is sort of past her like early fame and trying to figure out what to do next.
Right.
And then you wrote a book called Former Child Star. And yes. And so, you know, do you feel kind of hooked into this community now, like? Are you on speed dial from the guy who used to be on the Donna Reed show, who's now the always advocating for kid actor rights?
I wouldn't say speed dial, but a little bit. Like, that sort of stuff, because I've written, you know, articles, journalism-wise, following up when, you know, the quote, child star goes bad.
Oh.
Right. Which is, that sort of, I actually think, starting with the book, that's almost become, like, a mission of sort is to sort of, it's such an easy story to track the quote gone bad. And what does that mean? And
right.
Why is it a child star? And if you actually, there's a Danny Bonaducci quote, which I think kind of puts the thing in perspective. He talks about being in rehab and he was the one child star and there were like 9 dentists there. We don't talk about dentists going bad. I mean, whatever you define as going bad is, and usually what? Often we're talking about rehab, so that's gone bad. You're a bad person if you have addiction issues. Or
that you are now addressing.
Yeah, exactly. So that makes you a bad person. Okay. But, you know, I think I'm fascinated with our fascination with it, of why we're fascinated with it. And I think it just goes back to whatever era of kid star you grew up with, that's sort of the one that's your fixation. And then you're kind of interested perhaps in what happened to them in the same way that you're interested of what happened to people you went to school with.
Sure.
They're your virtual peers. And, you know, there's that, maybe it's wrong, but there's that charge you get if you see that, hey, the guy who was the quarterback, you know, he didn't turn out so good. I think I turned out better than him. That's cool. And I think
he got fat and bald.
I think there's like this instinct, and it's not one of our better instincts, that does that. And I think that's what so much drives a lot of the child star.
A lot of schadenfreude in there.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, and as a parent yourself, do you find yourself like kind of, have you learned things from this world that you apply in terms of like, no, you're not auditioning for that commercial, or
So I have a kid who's 8, going on 9, and he hasn't mentioned it. It's not something that it has come This is the thing I've learned during podcasts, as I mentioned in mine, is that when you actually speak out loud and extemporaneously, you learn all words that you can't pronounce and sentences that you cannot say off the top of your head. It is what was that?
Wait, so sorry. Okay, yeah, sorry. GarageBand does that thing that it does where it just decides to stop and then it starts again. So
that's a kind of a recent development.
Yeah, it is. I know.
Why is that happening?
And Chris Lavoie sent me an email. Oh, you should use this other software instead. I was like, don't confuse me with new things. Anyway, so you were saying.
Word I was looking for, it's not generic or genetically. What's the word? It's like organic.
There we go.
Which has a G sound.
It has an ick.
That's what I was going for.
It's got the ick.
So it's nothing that has come by organically. He doesn't appear interested in it. I think I'm kind of learning a little bit because I think what I am a little bit is a sports parent. He plays baseball, and I kind of feel that pull of, are you pushing him to do this team? Are you pushing him to do that? And if you don't, like, give him a nudge, does he do nothing?
Right.
Or, you know, how much is too much? So, you know, I think what I've learned and what I would do if he was, you know, I wouldn't let him join, like, a team and travel around the country, like, pretty much. I mean, that's what, you know, your pop star, your generic pop star grows up on the road or grows up with maybe perhaps not under your influence,
sure.
if you're a good influence. And it's the successful people who come through that as a child, I think, have strong influences. They have people who were watching their back. I heard you guys discussing the Amy Winehouse documentary. Mm-hmm. You're talking about, you know, exactly. The people who are just maybe like in her band because, not like her musical band, but in her group because she can bring them dollar signs or what can they get out of her and maybe not looking out for her best interest.
Right.
And the people who come out of this stuff, whether or not you're a child, a teenager, or whatever age, are surrounded by people who have their best interests.
You think that's the main difference between the people who implode and the ones who either become successful adult actors or just become successful adults
right.
in some other field?
That, and also I just think people who come from more compromised backgrounds mm-hmm. have more trouble. Just in no matter what, if you're a Boy Scout and you're coming from a family that's messed up, you're probably going to grow up to be perhaps the ex-Boy Scout who didn't turn out so well.
Right.
You know, Lindsay Lohan is going to have problems whether or not she is in TV and movies when she's a kid. She's from a volatile family environment.
Right.
I don't want to say it's 100% destinies you can't change or she can't like have a fantastic second half of her life, but it's a big challenge. And if and what the money and fame does is make all that stuff bigger, so
sure.
maybe she buys herself bigger problems or she has bigger problems because again then there's the money involved and then people want to know, you know, that the money absolutely corrupts everything if there's already underlying issues.
Well, what were you saying?
No.
Okay. Well, we might let us segue then into one of the films we're going to talk about this week, which is the new documentary "Listen to Me, Marlon," which is getting a small theatrical run before premiering on Showtime, and it's very much kind of a first person Marlon Brando documentary. He made a lot of audio recordings throughout his life, and they are paired with film clips and stills and even sort of a weird digital computer recreation of his head that I guess he did for Superman or something.
I don't know why he did that.
I think I heard he did it actually after it was done later. He did it to do it because I think there's a line where he talks about how they're going to be able to digitally recreate actors or something.
Right.
I think
right.
he wanted his head preserved.
Yeah.
Right.
Like digitally.
Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if they go, I mean, you know, once they had Fred Astaire dancing with a vacuum cleaner, the floodgates were open, but no, I just wanted to touch on that because he talks about his, you know, his distant father and just sort of various childhood stuff. And, you know, when we talked about the Amy Winehouse doc and we were sort of saying how, you know, Valley of the Dolls seems kind of ridiculous, but in a lot of ways it's very true about the trajectory of a lot of these folks. And, you know, there's that line that Roxy Hart has in Chicago about, you know, performers and audiences, you know, feeding love to each other because they didn't get enough love in their childhoods. And that's a thing, you know. I think, you know, I've talked to publicists who've said, because it's so depressing, you see these people who are just desperate to be famous because they think that's finally going to make their parents love them. And then they bring the parents out for like a premiere or whatever. And that didn't work. The parents still don't care.
Right. Right.
So I was thinking about that, just watching Brando, even like a successful adult Brando with his father.
Oh, you
still
see that? There's that scene, right?
It's that
a, they're
weird
on a
Mike
TV
Wallace
interview
clip
show,
whatever,
right?
Yeah.
And he's there with his father, and his father just says, "Are you?" I think they ask him something like, "You proud of him?" And he goes, he basically starts more or less kind of like, "No."
He's like, "Well, not as an actor, yeah, but as a man."
Yeah,
you know?
And then
which doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So it's soul killing, and then, that whole documentary is soul-killing. I mean, it's just so sad to watch because it's like that line, I guess, in one of the Superman movies, maybe where they use his voice, where it's the sins of the father.
Right.
You can see he even acknowledges his father was raised by messed up people. His father's messed up. He's messed up. His kids are messed up.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't end.
Yeah. But, you know, still, this amazing artist, you know, created all this stuff, although it's such a weird trajectory for him because, you know, he goes from being like this super acclaimed actor to then becoming this almost sort of bloated self-parody of himself and then back to being acclaimed and then back to being self-parody. It kind of goes back and forth. And you know, it's weird that Johnny Depp was so close to him and sort of, you know, almost apprenticed under him because he's kind of doing the same thing.
Yeah, currently, yes, he is. He's in all these films where he just is hiding behind, you know,
mannerisms,
a crazy costume, crazy makeup, and you see some of the lesser Brando films, and they usually involve him, you know.
Yeah, doing a weird walk or a lisp or something.
Makes me wonder what's going on with Johnny Depp.
Well, yeah, you know, it's like, because, you know, they did Don Juan DeMarco together, and then Brando was in that movie that Johnny Depp directed that we'll apparently never see, called The Brave.
Yeah.
That was just roundly excoriated. It premiered at the Cannes Film Festival and was just booed off the screen, and it's gotten a DVD release in other countries, but never in the U.S., never theatrical, never anything in this country. You really have to search for it hardcore if you want to see it. I've never seen it, but yeah, so Brando was in that movie, so they were tight. And so, yeah, it's kind of bizarre to watch Brando's triumphs and foibles play out in a way in Depp's career.
What I found interesting about it, after I watched it, because of all the audio and because of all the cool, creepy, like, Superman head, which, by the way, takes me back to when I first saw Superman the movie in a theater about 10 years old. I had gotten there late the first time I saw it, so the first thing I saw was, like, Marlon Brando's head. he was about to send them to the Phantom Zone, and I was, like, so enthralled and terrified of his head. It was amazing that I got through this movie. But it's so theatrical. I mean, because they have so much cool stuff, and as a movie, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It's a really good, I think, up until the end, and is it a spoiler alert to say he dies?
I think people
know. He died.
Okay. But it's, I think up until the very end, it's a really good representation of kind of like what you were talking about, the ups and downs and kind of like the mess. I think I'd gone, after I watched it, he wrote an autobiography in the 90s, and the New York Times reviewed and talked about how the autobiography is kind of like rambling, and it's stories that are here and there and up and down. And I thought, that's exactly, I mean, that's him then. This documentary is him. It's like, it's just a mess. It's just kind of like it starts out, it's such, I think, would be an inspiring documentary for actors at the beginning, because he talks about the technique. I think it's a really interesting documentary about acting at the beginning.
Sure.
And then about half hour in, he gets to the point where acting is stupid and they're liars and it's terrible. And then he likes it again, and he's just all over the map. It's like he has moments of self-awareness and then he doesn't. And he's dead on about Native Americans, but because maybe that's like an external thing that he can like process, and he's dead on. And then he's just, the rest of it is such.
And then he's really weird about Tahiti.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Like, you're so smart about what's going on in this country, and yet then you treat this other island as sort of like your simple person paradise.
Yeah,
and
he's like, being such a colonialist without realizing it.
That's exactly what I thought. I never understand people like who. I suppose it's better to say you like a people rather than you blanketly hate like a type of people. So but it's still kind of like weird. Like what? Like exactly. But what he likes is what he's perceiving is like they're simple and they're all about love.
Yeah. Like, he even says they're like sleeping children. Yeah. And I thought, dude, come on.
But then you look at him in a movie like Burn, which, I mean, he didn't write or direct it, but still is this very sort of searing indictment of white colonialism in the Caribbean, you know. So he couldn't have been, he wasn't completely clueless, but he just had, I think, lapses of, you know, maybe didn't think it through.
You know how it is. You go on vacation somewhere, you fall in love with a place. You want to live there.
And he was having a terrible time making Mutiny on the Bounty, so it seemed like, you know, these people aren't yelling at me. I like them.
That I didn't know, that Mutiny on the Bounty is like his like breaking point. Like,
oh yeah,
he lost it there, or maybe it's the moment. What I guess what I also found was an interesting look at fame, and what you were mentioning, Alonzo, about you can do all this stuff to try to get the love of your parents, if that's what it is, and it's not going to work. And it's like, it's the same, like maybe he was looking at fame or whatever, and it's going to fill that hole or something he's got. And then you get it, and it was so unsatisfying to him. And then it's like, oh, then I guess I'm just going to do it for the money or for whatever reason.
He says early on,
you've got to climb Mount Everest to reach the Valley of the Dolls. That's all I'm saying.
He says early on that the screaming crowds frighten him. And they're screaming for him. They're not coming after him. They love him, and he's frightened of them. And then, you know, later on, like you said, he's like, well, this is now a thing that I have to do for 3 months out of the year to make a living.
Yeah.
And that's it. And
I totally get the whole fan thing. I mean, that's just on the perspective of the pursuit. That's terrifying. I mean, I just remember one time I was going to dinner with a friend of mine who's a publicist, and we had to like make this. He had to stop by some screening that had just happened at the Writers Guild because his client at the time was Diane Lane, former child star herself, and just the 500 feet or so of the sidewalk she had to walk right. to get to her car.
Yeah.
This blinding array of flash photography. And this was at a, you know, low-key event over at the Writers Guild Theater. Not the, you know, biggest celebrity on earth. And just that moment, I was like, ah! You know, so I can't imagine being white hot famous at a world premiere of a movie, you know, like just the multiplication involved of just that little scrum of paparazzi, and then you add like screaming fans and Klieg lights and all that other stuff. It just seems too much.
I've often thought of Michael Jackson, if you've ever seen like the reverse shots of like him on stage in front of like wherever he was, and there's like a million people in the audience, and it's like you want to know why Michael Jackson was not exactly like grounded in most people's reality. It's like you be in that spotlight and just see if that doesn't mess with your head.
There's a great bit in the Monkees movie Head, where they're performing in front of a screaming crowd, and then eventually the crowd like descends upon the stage and literally tears them apart, like they're mannequins or whatever, but they're just like shrieking and you know, and yeah, it's a fine line.
That's what Cintra Wilson, who I always talk about,
yes,
when this subject comes up.
If you've never read A Massive Swelling, you really should.
Take a note on that one.
She was talking, I interviewed her once, and I think I've actually told this story on the show before. She says the screaming is sexual hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
That it's, I have to have sex with this person, I have to have sex with this person, I have to have sex with this person. Oh my God, I will never get to have sex with this person. What's wrong with me? Ah! Yeah. So, literally, she was mentioning Tom Cruise. She said, I have to F Tom Cruise. I have to F Tom Cruise. I will never F Tom Cruise. I'm a disaster, and now I scream. Yeah.
And I guess that's our segue into Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, which opened this weekend. Yeah, it's, you know, spies, and they're on the run because someone got the list or the thing, and they're all being...
Don't you remember what happens?
Okay.
Oh, you're forgetting what happens?
So what happens...
Shall I tell you?
No. I think I got this. Tell me if I'm getting it wrong. All right. So, the... Ethan Hunt, Tom Cruise's character, has been pursuing this shadowy organization that's been providing arms to terrorists, and it turns out that they do exist, and they, in fact, they are now sort of running everything, and they are out to eliminate him and the rest.
And they're called the Syndicate. Yeah.
They're out to eliminate him and the rest of his IMF team by absorbing them into the CIA.
A little interruption.
Mm-hmm.
Have I not been paying full enough attention?
That they've been called the IMF
this
whole time?
They've been called the IMF this
whole
time?
They were called that on the TV show, too.
Were they?
Yeah, the Impossible Mission Force.
That is correct.
I guess I've never, ever once, through four other Mission Impossible
that they were also the International Monetary Fund.
I even in this movie, when they talk about being in the IMF, after they say what it is once, for the rest of the film, I think, the International Mission... Fellows? Like, what? Who are they? Again?
Well, I mean, movie's called Mission Impossible.
I know the Impossible Mission, and then the F part is what I kept forgetting.
Fox Force 5.
Yeah. I that part has just always sort of gone in one ear and out the other with me, which makes me feel bad about myself and my ability to pay attention to anything. Continue.
Okay, so CIA chief Alec Baldwin is trying to call in Ethan from the field, and they've managed to drag in Jeremy Renner and Simon Pegg, but they're both being very cagey about not giving away where Tom Cruise is, even lying to lie detector tests. Tom Cruise fools them into thinking that he's in Havana, but he's actually in Paris, and then he goes to...
That was a good bit.
And then he goes to Vienna... to foil an assassination at the opera, and he sees this woman who had previously helped him escape in London, and she is played by Rebecca Ferguson and is great in this because she's crazy sexy. And
all y'all gonna know the name Rebecca Ferguson.
Yeah, and she is not famous, so you don't know for a long time if she's a good witch or a bad witch. You know, you can never quite tell where her allegiances lie, and so that's exciting because you know if it was a recognizable name, of course, obviously she's going to be a good guy, but in this movie we don't know. So, yeah, much running around and globetrotting and double dealing and fighting and chasing and exploding. And I liked it a lot. I'd say my only qualm is that by the time they get to the last big action set piece, I was a little exhausted. Like, the movie hadn't quite paced them out or spaced them out enough, you know, to sort of make each one exciting. And so by that last one, it was kind of an ice cream headache of like, I'm good. We don't need another one of these.
I'm going to disagree with you about the ice cream headache.
Okay.
I felt like this was exactly enough, and every moment of it was exciting and ridiculous and smart. And
I mean, it's not a question of quantity, obviously, because The Raid 2 is like, what, 2.5 hours long?
Right, right.
You know, and I love that movie start to finish.
Yeah. I really love this film. This is the kind of thing I would pay to go see again.
I would probably.
It's that much fun, without simply being fun. Because there are films out there that you sit through and you know they're kind of whatever. But you, when they're done, you say, well, you know, I had fun. It's not great, but I had fun.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is great.
Really?
And fun. Yeah.
Do you like it more than Ghost Protocol?
I like it just as much as Ghost Protocol.
Okay.
It's
directed by Christopher McQuarrie, who wrote The Usual Suspects and wrote and directed Jack Reacher.
Yeah.
Jack
Reacher, underrated.
Jack Reacher was fun.
People should see Jack Reacher. And it's very strange.
And it had like nothing supporting roles for both Rosamund Pike and David Oyelowo, who have since gone on to be like a big deal. So.
Right. Getting back to the supporting character, Rebecca Ferguson.
Yes.
If you are English.
True. You've seen her on TV.
Well, I believe she's a Swedish actress, isn't she?
Yes, but she's done a lot of British television.
Right. There's a singer in England also named Rebecca Ferguson.
Oh.
And she had kind of like a minor song. Popular over here too, that I'm blanking on the name of, but she
Friday.
Now there are two. What?
Is it Friday?
Yes, she sang Friday. She's from Liverpool. I don't know a whole bunch about her.
Okay,
but there are two Rebecca Fergusons in the world of entertainment now.
This is the other one.
But now you're going to know this one more than you're going to know the singer.
Yes.
Because, yeah. Here's what I love the most about this. If you had talked to me however many years ago when MI3 came out, which I really did not like.
Which has its defenders. Like Amy Nicholson was on What the Flick this week, Tom Cruise expert that she is.
Amy's the president of Tom Cruise.
Yes, well, that's her favorite one because she says it has the best villain, which it does, but that doesn't make it the best movie.
It is the one I liked, I think, the least.
Me too. I think 2 is very underrated, and yeah, it's John Woo at his woo-wooiest, but it's still entertaining.
I believe that these films represent a strategic operation on the part of Tom Cruise. I believe that as the, you know, this is his baby. Mm-hmm. You know, he took this thing and he turned it into a vehicle to resurrect himself. And I don't know that he thought about that at the beginning, because I don't think he was in need of a resurrection.
Yeah.
At the beginning.
In 1996.
But he goes through this very, very public fall from grace with the public.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just before the release of MI3, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just before War
of the Worlds.
War of the Worlds. Right. Sorry. And has used these films and Jack Reacher to sort of ingratiate is the wrong word, to prove it again. Whereas, you know, you can say, I don't like this weird thing about you and I don't like this other weird thing about you.
But by cracky, you're a movie star.
But if you can keep on bringing this, you know, level of movie star quality and movie star entertainment to us,
well, there's almost
we are going to We are going to forget about the weird things.
There's almost this sense of, I don't know if it's abnegation, but when he hangs on an airplane or, you know, stays underwater for longer than he should, it's almost like the movie star hair shirt, you know?
Yeah.
Like he is publicly, you know, sacrificing himself in a way. Like there's this weird level of I don't even know what my Catholic saint suffering word here is.
Exfoliate?
Yes, he's exfoliating himself for the public. No, he is like performing this act of kind of ritual self-torture in a way to sort of negate the fact that he is this widely overpaid and overexposed, you know, movie star. So it's the notion of, look, I see how I'm dicing death for you.
And he very sort of famously is on record as doing most of those stunts.
Right, yeah.
And that's insane because he did jump on that plane. Like, yeah. That's a thing that he did. And it's, now that I know it, it's horrifying to me.
And in my review of the rap, I said that, you know, it's sort of like it's the equivalent of playing the hit single first.
Yes.
You know, that whole airplane thing was the whole marketing of this movie. It's on the poster. And that thing happens before the credits.
In the first 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, okay, so this is what you came to see. Now look what else we got for you.
Right.
You know? And they do keep ratcheting it up from there. It's pretty great.
So I find my relationship to him on the screen has changed. 10 years ago, I very distinctly remember being on the radio with that morning DJ Valentine.
Mm, yeah.
He still got his morning show, but I am no longer
welcome.
No, they got rid. They got rid of me. They get rid of you all the time. You know what I mean? It's like you come and you go.
I'm kidding.
And they were all gung ho for MI3, and I just said Tom Cruise to me is like this big empty box of nothing, and I meant it at the time because I felt nothing when I saw him on screen. And now that has changed. I look at him and I say, you are here to entertain me, and I'm very happy to have that happen, and you're welcome, movie actor friend.
It's a shrewd trajectory, for sure.
I checked out on the Mission Impossible franchise probably after 10 minutes or three. Not my kind of movies. I mean, they're okay. So I haven't seen the new one, so let me preface that. But what, David, you were saying about how he's really latched onto this franchise, it really has. It's truly like his life preserver.
Yeah.
In a way, because he's the anti-Marlon Brando. It is, he still has that need to be a movie star.
Yes.
And I've only felt kind of bad for his career in the wake of the Katie Holmes stuff and what went down 10 years ago, that he's still fighting back because he's more focused on the Mission Impossible movies. He used to mix it up with kind of like a popcorn movie, and then he would do
Magnolia.
Right, exactly, right?
Yes.
And he actually, and that was sort of just a way that movie stars behaved also 10, 20, 30 years ago. They would make serious dramas. And so it's either partly a function of the marketplace that you don't do that anymore. But two, it's like he's not even going to go there. He's going, well, he's going to have that fame. He's going to do this. He's going to work really hard.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because Amy, our friend Amy Nicholson from LA Weekly, who has written a book about Tom Cruise, says that post-couch jumping Tom Cruise needs to be in a really big, giant hit before he allows himself to do something along the lines of Magnolia again. But I mean, let's not forget, it's easy to think of him as kind of a dullard or this very sort of mainstream at all costs. I'd say of any living actor right now in the United States, not counting somebody like, you know, Catherine Deneuve, he's worked with more important filmmakers.
Yes.
I mean, this is a guy who's worked with Kubrick and Scorsese and De Palma and Oliver Stone and, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson and, you know, and so... Yeah, I think he's always been very canny about not just going for the paycheck, like balancing it out, kind of deepening his own portfolio. And I hope that he continues to do that now that this apparently was his biggest opening. Rogue Nation was his biggest opening since War of the Worlds 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Hopefully, he, you know, after, unfortunately, Edge of
Edge of Tomorrow.
Edge of Tomorrow,
which was also really, really great.
A terrific movie and a very smart movie for him to make because it allowed him to play that sort of classic 1940s kind of character of the cad who becomes a better person in the army.
Yes.
You know, and because it did literally offer the spectacle of Tom Cruise dying over and over, over and over again. And over, yeah. Even people who didn't like Tom Cruise could sort of enjoy that aspect of it, you know.
I feel like, you know, earlier in his career, my sense of him being empty was most sort of perfectly realized in Eyes Wide Shut. And that's why it's my favorite of his films.
Because
mm-hmm. I think Kubrick maybe saw something similar.
You think Kubrick Kier delayed him, basically?
I can do something with this guy. But Amy makes a good point in her review of Rogue Nation, Amy Nicholson. And it's something that I had sort of half thought about, but hadn't really fully brought to a fully executed thought, and she did. He allows directors to mold him. He allows directors to do things with him. He goes after them to work on his projects, and then he lets them do what they want with him. And so in one sense, I don't think anymore that he is empty. I think that he is simply really malleable. And although not always incredibly dynamic, he will shape himself to fit what the film is. And I think that's really, that makes him interesting to me.
Sure. Well, I think where he comes off as an empty vessel is in interviews with him, where he kind of does
that. Yeah, because he's got to control that.
Yeah. It's locked down. He has that laugh that he always does and that smile. And it just starts feeling kind of creepy and disingenuous after a while or insincere.
When you are that guy, you're going to be that. Barricaded, yeah. I think.
And do you notice any difference of the way he does interviews now than prior to the Katie Holmes poker business?
None. No, I see no difference.
I think he's back to that guy that he was before. He's always been kind of, at arm's length to any sort of that kind of genuine public image. But again, if he's somebody who has the personality that allows himself to be molded by directors, you know, it's sort of like when I had to do that Q&A with Christopher Walken. Like, I think part of what makes him a great actor is that off the screen, there's no there.
Right.
You know, and so if that's the deal with Tom Cruise and it all goes into the work, then let it go into the work and we'll enjoy the work. And they don't owe us their personal lives, you know.
Well, according to Good Day Sacramento, they
that's
a Cara Delevingne.
Team Delevingne.
I'm totally Team Delevingne on that one.
The John Green defense of her, he posted it on Medium, is well worth a read.
Oh, I didn't see
it. It's and he talks about the not to derail this, but very briefly, he talks about just the what a chore it is. While he understands it's a privilege to make these movies and get paid, but to do the junkets and to answer the same questions a million times. And frankly, she was answering their questions. That's the most puzzling thing of the reaction there.
And I'm sure she couldn't see their faces. There's always that tape delay. You know, or whatever. There's a couple seconds of the satellite bouncing.
I know what this was. I know what this was.
What?
Model bigotry.
Well, that too.
That's what
they
wanted
to take the pretty girl down.
Oh, you're a model? I bet you're an idiot. And that's always the way it goes. Always.
Jeffrey Self, the comedian actor, has done a very cool. He did a video where he spliced himself doing Cara Delevingne in with the original interview questions, and he does look eerily like her in a wig. I have to say, they have similar facial structure.
Funny.
The other big national release of this weekend is the Vacation sequel/reboot.
Sucks.
Yeah.
Move on.
We don't really need to get into that one too deeply, except I weirdly find myself hating it less than other people. Matt actually completely despised it, whereas I laughed 5 or 6 times, and that was 5 or 6 times more than I laughed at The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, which the same guys wrote. They're now directing.
Right.
And more than I laughed at Horrible Bosses 2, which those guys wrote. So, I think I went in with, you know, the soft bigotry of low expectations. I just thought it was going to be so completely irredeemable. The fact that there were a handful of laughs in it made it not as rotten as I thought it would be.
I laughed at the brawl.
Pixels of comedies.
Yeah. I laughed at the brawl on the roller coaster.
That was okay. I liked the sorority house sequence with Christina Applegate.
Yeah, like this. I laughed actually probably more than you did, and yet, walking out of it, I had this overwhelming sense of its shapelessness.
I certainly didn't leave on a high.
It has
feeling any
no,
kind of joy.
It has no reason to exist. It was poorly executed, poorly planned, poorly written. You were not on anyone's side in this film, because the Ed Helms character is a dimwit who needs to be corrected all the time.
Although, but even that, and from scene to scene, there were other times where he was sort of less of a naif than he is at other times, so they don't even really nail down a
really inconsistent character.
John Francis Daly, who used to star on Freaks and Geeks, and Jonathan Goldstein, they're the writers, and now this is the first time they've directed. And I don't think they have enough skill to do the thing that this movie needs to do, which is to give you characters that you care about to some extent, or at least can commit to seeing through, that at the same time you can enjoy their humiliation. That's a tricky thing to do in comedy. It's doable, but they don't know how to do it.
When they are humiliated, you want to feel a little bit of empathy.
Right.
But not here. You just are waiting for the next humiliation. The Ed Helms character is inconsistent. The Christina Applegate character is barely there.
Yeah.
Her job is to react and say, oh, a lot of the time.
Well, that's why I like the sorority scene.
Other than at the sorority house
That's
scene.
Her moment to do something.
And the two sons are
totally phony,
badly written characters. The oldest one doesn't make any sense. The youngest one is such a toxic creation that after 10 minutes of this kid being on screen, you think to yourself, child abuse
might be justified.
Not a bad thing all the time, really, is it?
Yeah, like you never buy that the parents would be that oblivious that they would allow him to continue to behave like that, not only to his older brother, but to them.
To everyone, this child, this character is a monster. And the kid who's playing him is, you know, fine at being a monster, but this character is a monster, and you hate him. Mm. I actually hated this child in the film, and I thought, well, I just want him to fall out of the car. I want them to leave him in the road somewhere. That's what they should do.
Imogene Coca style.
Yeah.
If you notice the two son trend, it's usually, I find that interesting. I noticed that, in this movie, you have two sons rather than boy-girl.
And Jurassic World, same thing.
And I thought, that's good. So that way, they won't expect to have girls won't expect to have parts when they become women.
Right. Exactly,
I'll cut out of the picture now.
I had this very conversation with Ingu Kang, because she covers a lot of women's film issues stuff for IndieWire. And it's like, there was at least lip service towards including women in these stories, and now we can't even be bothered to do that in like a tiny fraction of a way.
Really, really bad.
A couple of really good indie movies opening in limited release this weekend. One is The End of the Tour,
which I have not seen,
which is from the director of The Spectacular Now.
Can you tell me if it is? I have had the unfortunate experience of seeing the trailer for The End of the Tour three times now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like to watch trailers at all.
Yeah, no, I know.
And I certainly don't like to watch heinously insufferable trailers, which is how they have cut this one together.
Oh, okay. No, the movie
is not... To make these characters look like the two biggest pains in the ass.
No.
All right, tell me.
They are not heinously insufferable.
Okay.
That's
right. I said ass again. I said it last week. Woo. We didn't bleep it. You know why? Because it's not considered a swear on primetime television anymore.
That's right.
Therefore, it fits in with the clean podcast.
Our clean podcast.
How you like me now? Gonna say ass.
So Jesse Eisenberg plays David...
Foster Wallace.
No. That's Jason Segel plays David Foster Wallace. Smarty pants know-it-all. Jesse Eisenberg plays the other David, who's a journalist for Rolling Stone. At the beginning of the film, we see that he has just published a novel But, you know, it very few people show up for the reading. It's like, it's not considered a big deal. I found out later that it was named one of the best books of the year by Time magazine. But for the purposes of this movie, we're supposed to believe that this David's novel was a failure.
I see.
So he then, you know, pitches his editor at Rolling Stone, again, Ron Livingston, who is also in Vacation.
Yes.
To let him follow around David Foster Wallace, because Infinite Jest is the book of the moment, and everyone's raving about it. And
yes, it is.
It's selling, and the reviews are rapturous.
It's
and
sitting on our bookshelf, and neither one of us have ever read it.
I started it, but I could not continue. I will maybe try it again. Maybe this movie made me kind of want to try it again, and that's saying something, because that thing terrifies me.
I have read...
I
read The Broom of the System in the 80s when it came out. And then I read The Girl with Curious Hair, which is a collection of short stories. And then I haven't read a single thing about of his since then.
Yeah. So he goes to Bloomington, where Foster Wallace is teaching, and then they go to Minneapolis together for like his last kind of bookstore reading, and they spend a lot of time in cars and in airplanes and in diners, and there's always the tape recorder there, and apparently a lot of the dialogue comes straight from the tapes of David's article that was never published by Rolling Stone, but after David Foster Wallace died, the other David turned the transcripts into a book.
Why was it never published?
They don't even mention it in the movie. I was told this later that it never became an article.
Weird.
So the movie is really about this interesting dynamic of, you know, big king of the world novelist and sort of struggling novelist and interviewee and interviewer and two guys who might have enough in common that they would be friends, but there's always that tape recorder between them, so one's very cagey about what he's talking about, and the other one has an agenda to maybe bring up things that he wouldn't have brought up otherwise, and so it's virtually a two-hander. I mean, there are a couple of other characters that pop up, some women who are friends of David Foster Wallace's who show up for his reading in Minneapolis, and Joan Cusack plays like the bookstore, like the lady who drives him around to stuff, and Becky Ann Baker is the woman who owns the bookstore, but for the most part, it's really just Siegel and Eisenberg kind of facing off and you know, doing this elaborate dance that kind of, you know, emerges between these two guys who are very similar but are, you know, in very different places and having this conversation with very different roles. And to watch that is fascinating. I mean, this could be a play.
Yeah.
You know, because so much of it really just comes down to the conversations. But I love a good movie that's based on conversation. I mean, when you look at, like, My Dinner with Andre, or, you know, I was always a fan of Mindwalk, or, you know, a lot of Romer works this way.
Yes.
You know, that it, you know, and
Clerks.
Clerks, sure. and even, you know, and I've always thought there was something kind of Romer-esque about Siegel's work with Judd Apatow,
yes.
You know, both Forgetting Sarah Marshall and The 5-Year Engagement.
I agree with you.
So it's kind of fun to see him play this character that's not like the usual Jason Siegel character. I don't know enough about David Foster Wallace to know how accurately he's getting him, but it does feel like he's playing a role. He's playing somebody else. And I was captivated. I really enjoyed it. Bibbs was bananas about it. Like, it's one of his favorite movies of the year, and
really?
I wasn't that enraptured by it, but I liked it a lot, and I found it endlessly fascinating.
Okay.
And it's interesting to compare it to True Story, that was also both of those films are at Sundance this year. True Story, also based on a real interview,
yeah.
Also featuring you know, a former Freaks and Geeks cast member and and Judd Apatow grads,
yeah.
And a terrible movie. but this one's really good.
Who's in True Story? What's
True Story? Is the one with James Franco and Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill
is the New York Times reporter who gets fired for plagiarism, and then he finds out that James Franco, who's on death row, was using his name and identity when he was like hiding out in Mexico. So they go and meet, and not a very good movie. And it's actually weirdly on DVD this week, but end of the tour. I very much recommend.
I saw Phoenix.
Oh yeah. Oh gosh. Okay. Yeah. We forgot about that one. Okay. Tell me about Phoenix.
It's opening in limited release this week. It's a German film from Christian Petzold. He made Barbara, which I never saw. Did you see Barbara?
I did not see it. I've heard of it, but I didn't see it.
We actually have a DVD somewhere floating around in
the award screener or whatever.
Mount Unwatched pile over there. But this is a film set right after the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And Nina Hoss plays a woman who is presumed dead. She has been sent to a concentration camp. And she comes home so disfigured that she needs months of hospitalization and reconstructive surgery. But when she is finished with all of that, she is no longer recognizable to herself or to anyone else.
So it's a remake of The Girl Most Likely To.
Absolutely. Yes. That is totally what this is. Why don't you tell people what you're referring to?
That's the TV movie from the early 70s that Joan Rivers wrote, starring Stockard Channing. Google it. I can't do everything for you.
It's it is 1,000% not like the Joan Rivers film.
Okay.
So she's unrecognizable. And then she learns from a good friend that the reason she was in the concentration camp to begin with was that her husband sold her out to the Nazis to save his own skin.
Were they both Jewish?
Nope.
Oh, I see.
Yep. They were, you know, nightclub people. Ah. You know, she was a singer and, yeah. So she meets the husband.
And oh, he doesn't recognize her?
He doesn't recognize her.
Oh, don't say anything else.
So this is like the unfunny to be or not to be. Okay. It's totally not like The Girl Most Likely.
He doesn't recognize her. So, a little bit of vertigo, a little bit of sympathy for Lady Vengeance.
Hmm.
Oh boy, is this movie good.
Okay.
Oh man, is this movie good. And when I say that, I don't mean that it's showy or loud or crazy or violent. It
weaves a web.
Skillfully executed. And I went to see it with Art Movie Brother.
Yes.
Matt. And he said something at the end. He said, you know what? There's nothing really showy about Christian Petzold's direction. It's very sort of classical. And there's not a... There's not a style.
Uh-huh.
It just slowly absorbs you and engulfs you and takes you in. And this film moves quietly toward a really satisfying outcome. I won't tell you anything other than that. But it's pretty incredible.
Also in limited release this week is Best of Enemies. Which was my favorite movie at Sundance this year. And then it was one of our documentary centerpieces at Outfest. And so I'm excited that it's finally in theaters. It's from Morgan Neville, who won an Oscar for 20 Feet from Stardom. And Robert Gordon, who is a Grammy-winning documentarian. And it is about the sort of legendary Gore Vidal, William F. Buckley Jr. debates that took place on ABC News in the summer of 1968 as part of their gavel-to-gavel coverage of the political conventions that year, 1968, of course, being a flashpoint really worldwide for protests and social unrest. And certainly that was the case in Miami and Chicago, where the conventions were happening. ABC News, in a distant third place, needed to do something to shake things up. So,
what was the quote?
If LBJ wanted to end the Vietnam War, he should put it on ABC. It'll be canceled in 13 weeks. So they get these two kind of leading literary lights, one very very progressive and one very conservative, to take each other on in live television, and the results were electrifying and also perhaps ushered in, as usual, the lesson that TV took from it was the worst parts, not like, yes, let's get smart people, but let's get people who will yell insults at each other.
And make good television.
I love this movie. To me, it pushes so many of my buttons of the age in America where we had famous people of letters. You know, we were talking about this on What the Flick, and apart from Neil deGrasse Tyson, like, who is an academic or an intellectual that gets to be on The Tonight Show anymore?
Nobody.
Yeah.
We don't like eggheads.
No, exactly. No. We've turned into such an anti-intellectual bent in the society that you don't have these kind of... There's no equivalent to these guys now as far as sort of important thinkers, you know. And the people who are allowed on TV as quote-unquote experts is, you know, it's depressing.
I love any thing that goes back to, you know, lots of archival footage from the 60s, because everything looked great back then. If Mad Men has taught us anything, it's that everything looked great in the 60s. Until, of course, the hippies came along.
I was saying, except for riot gear.
Dirtied everything hippies. Up and ruined everything.
Hippies.
But the... And I'm fascinated by these two guys and how very, like, opposite sides of the preppy fence they are.
Yeah, they have so much in common in terms of their background and their upbringing and their education and even their failed political ambitions.
Right. If I have any quibble with the movie, it's based on what... it's based on my agreement with Ingu, who was unhappy that if you don't go into this film already knowing something about these guys, knowing the content of their intellectualism, knowing what they did and what they accomplished in the world. And the film does tell you what they accomplished.
Yeah.
If you don't go in knowing that, what you are given in much of the debate footage is them being bitches to one another. And that is fun.
But that's what they did.
That's fun, but it makes me want to watch the entire debate so that I can hear something about the issues that they were there to discuss.
I don't think that
we're... Did they get to those issues? Or did they simply insult each other for however many nights in a row?
Well, the thing is, I don't think they had a ton of time. I think you're seeing, if not completely unexpurgated, that's most of what those debates were about. They didn't have... It's not like they were given a full half hour or something.
How long were they given?
I think they were given like 10 minutes at the end of, you know...
Oh, so they weren't like... It wasn't the primetime show the night. They were a segment... No. They were a segment of the ABC News
coverage. They were like after the final gavel. Then they would bring them out to talk about that day's stuff. But then usually they would just sort of... They just basically went after each other. No, I think the movie... That's pretty much what America saw. I don't think they just selected like the bitchy highlights. I think that's really what they...
Where do I get to see the uncut footage, though?
Have you tried YouTube?
I will try YouTube.
Have you tried Hare Krishna?
No.
But that's kind of heartening. But you're saying 1968 was almost as shallow as today, because essentially they weren't talking... Maybe you're saying they didn't say that much more. They really did just come out and insult each other.
You have a point. That's true. Yeah, I mean, but they just... They said it so much classier.
Well, that's true.
Than these ruffians they let on the air today, you know.
Okay, well, then if that's the case, then they both sort of failed at their job.
I guess. I mean, I think they were treating each other as the representative of the thing they were speaking out against, and then that they just sort of segued into becoming very personal.
Right.
But it's still captivating to watch.
Still totally entertaining.
Interesting to hear about in the context of their careers, which I think the movie does a pretty good job of.
No, it does. Giving you an idea, who they were and what they did and the things they accomplished. But I too, I guess, much like Ingo, I thought, well, I was four, you know, when this happened. And so I've never seen the full debates. And if what we saw were highlights, then I wish we had seen a little more
meaty stuff. I kind
of
think we're seeing it all.
Other than the insults. But if that's everything, if we're being shown almost all of it, then that's crazy. Because they do almost nothing but insult each other back and forth.
Well, but in the context of, you know, like complaining about, you know, LBJ's policies or whatever,
right?
That's why they sort of use each other as the straw man in place of the larger argument. I don't know. It's a fascinating film. People should absolutely see it.
Okay, so we
and then
screwed up watching the Chris Farley documentary.
Yes.
What is the name of the Chris Farley documentary?
I am Chris Farley.
Yes. You were sent, Alonzo, a streaming link on your computer machine that you failed to open in time, and then it expired, and then the movie opened.
Yes.
And now it's too late for both you and me.
I know. I failed.
You failed yourself. Well, you failed me. You failed this podcast.
I know at least one publicist listens to this show, so I just want to say this, put this out there. As we get more and more into the thing where you're sending us these links to watch stuff online, Which we hate, by the way. And it's always very...
They're glitchy.
It's bug-filled.
Yeah.
Don't assume that we're going to open it the second you send it to us. So this expires in 7 days. Bourgeois is just not helpful to anyone. And if it is going to expire in 7 days, then maybe put in the header, expires in 7 days, so that I know that the clock is ticking.
It was sent to you by the IMF. So
there you go.
The International Mission... Impossible Fellows.
Foundation.
Frickin' frack. All right, so, but... So Joel, we meant to see... I watched it before the link expired.
Our guest, Joel.
You're better at this than we are.
I did not know. So tell us about this thing.
Please report.
I'll make it brief, because I actually, once I watched it, I felt bad that I told you guys this opening and was going to make you guys watch it, because as the Listen to Me Marlin is such a great movie and theatrical, and this is, it's not really a movie. It's kind of like, I feel bad, sort of. I feel kind of bad because it's Chris Farley, the comedian from Saturday Night Live, who died in his early 30s in 1998.
Yeah.
I believe it was heart attack, drugs, drug-induced heart attack.
All that stuff.
Yes. So that's sad. He clearly was beloved by a generation of comedians from Saturday Night Live.
Right.
The guys. Adam Sandler is in it. Bob Odenkirk. I kind of find it fascinating because I really respect Bob Odenkirk and love Mr. Show. Mm. That Chris Farley could be beloved by both the Adam Sandler wing and the Bob Odenkirk wing. Yeah. So I will give it that. And you obviously,
covered the waterfront.
He's beloved by these guys. And it's 90 minutes of really people telling stories of how much they like Chris Farley.
Yeah.
I feel like if you say that it's loud, then you're saying... I feel like I'm being mean.
Like
to
you're
Chris
reviewing
Farley.
His life
exactly,
somehow.
And I'm not. But if the movie was a man of gigantic appetites, both for food and for drugs. And they don't give any attempt to give you the why, or they don't attempt. I'm also completely of the school. Maybe sometimes there is no why, or no one will know, and they don't give me that either. They don't go, there was no reason. Everything in his life really was great, and his siblings are all for great. We really don't know why he was driven for more and more and more. There was actually an anecdote. It's not in this, but his appetite was so great. There's the Rob Lowe tells an anecdote in his memoir about meeting Chris Farley. What was it? Was it Tommy Boy? He's Tommy Boy. So he had dinner with Chris Farley, and Chris Farley got like steaks, and he, the little pats of butter you get with the steak sometimes, or sometimes steakhouse. So every bite that Chris Farley took, he put one pat of butter. Honestly, because he said it needs a little hat.
I support that decision. Actually,
I want to know what's going.
I need a ponchik.
That's someone who's if Marlon Brando or Tom Cruise is driven, they want the fame. Like, what is driving Chris Farley for this huge appetite? And it also can play if you are not really truly in the Chris Farley camp. Like, if you don't think they have a sketch. That they show a clip of. First of all, there's a lot of clips of Chris Farley on his one David Letterman appearance. There's a lot of clips from, they do the Chippendales scene from Saturday Night Live with Patrick Swayze. You see that a lot. And then at one point, they show a clip from Saturday Night Live where he's in a sketch called Pepper Boy, where Adam Sandler's a guy putting pepper on a drink. And they're telling the story about how it was so great. Chris Farley, he only had one line. He wasn't even the focus. He was just supposed to say thank you. But he put on a beard, and then he said thank you really loud. And it was like, it almost, if you don't think Pepper Boy is funny, it could play kind of like a parody. It's almost like a parody of like a documentary because they're just telling you how funny and great this guy was.
And then they show it to you. And
they show you Pepper Boy. Again. And if Pepper Boy made you laugh, I'm not judging that.
Sure.
I don't want to judge because if Chris Farley made you laugh and he made people laugh, I'm not going to tell you that you shouldn't laugh at Chris Farley.
So
does he seem like a perfectly... He didn't seem to hurt people.
Sure.
He was a nice person.
So this movie is basically the Chris Farley show.
Yeah. Yeah.
Remember when you were in that Pepper Boy sketch?
Yeah.
That was great.
That's kind of what it is. So that's your thing. And I guess this is a series of... I find it interesting this got a theatrical release. I mean, it's very small, but it is being in some theaters. But I think it's destined for Spike. And I think there's like a series of these documentaries that are called like I Am So-and-So. So this is the latest one.
Yeah. Are they all dead people or...
Don't know.
Is this the first one? Do we know?
No, I don't think this is.
Oh, there's another. Yeah. There are other ones. Yeah. All right.
And his brother was in that weird American Carol movie.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw the brothers that. Are in that, yeah.
Did you see that
I movie? Did not, no.
I saw that at the Beverly Center.
So you know a movie's being chucked at the public.
Bleh.
Also, Dave finally got around to the Stanford Prison Experiment this week.
Yes. That you know what? I don't have to hide my my feelings about it. It's a good film.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm glad you like it.
We know the director.
Yes.
Kyle Patrick Alvarez. And so that always fills me with fear.
I know.
When someone we know has a film in the world, I don't like to talk about it on the show.
Unless we like it.
Unless we like it. But then it sort of tips our hand that if we haven't talked about your film, then...
Yeah, I have still not had time to go see Mr. Holmes. I want to see Mr. Holmes.
We're not holding out on Mr. Holmes.
Yeah, we're not trying to like skirt the issue. We literally haven't seen it yet.
We're just failing at life.
But we're going to see it yet. We want to see it.
Now, the week it was released, you talked about it.
Stanford Prison Experiment.
Yes.
Yes, a little bit.
And what an unhappy, tense, miserable pre-lawsuit sort of experience that must have been for everybody. I mean, because this is the kind of thing that happens where if you did that today, everyone would get sued.
Right.
The level of violence...
No matter how many forms you sign.
...that goes on in this movie, for people who are being paid to participate in a university study, it blows my mind. Again, this is a thing that happened when I was, 5 or 6 years old, so I don't remember it very well.
What is the experiment?
The Stanford Prison Experiment happened at Stanford University, and they were... they took a group of, 15 male students... And paid them $15 a day, which was, at the time, I guess it was a reasonably crappy amount of money to pay someone for a university study. And they put them in isolation for 2 weeks and divided them up into two populations, prisoners and guards. And they simulated a prison in the halls of this building on campus. And within one day, within 24 hours, the guards had become brutal and violent toward the prisoners. And the prisoners began plans to escape and revolt.
Or they had total like Stockholm syndrome and just like sort of went along with it.
Right.
And tried not to make trouble. Yeah, it is this sort of, like, if you take a sociology class, like, they still talk about the Stanford Prison Experiment. It's this big thing that is referenced. And the guy, Dr. Zimbardo, who was the
still
around, consulted on the film.
Yeah.
I think, he's appeared at some screenings with Kyle, and I think they may have even recorded a commentary or something for the DVD.
Oh, really?
I hope they're going to. I can't remember if that finally happened or not. But he was there, so the people who've seen this movie who know about the experiment and who were involved with it all say that it gets it right, that they weren't it, that if you saw this as a narrative, which there have been narratives, it was Das Experiment and a few other films, you almost think, oh, come on, like that fast,
could this have happened?
But apparently
that quickly.
That fast, that's how it works.
Great, really great performance in this from Michael Angarano.
Yeah.
As the guard who decides to go Hollywood about it all,
full Cool Hand Luke,
and affects an accent, and
he becomes Strother Martin.
He becomes it's nuts.
That's crazy. You know what's crazy is you have things like this on the record, and you have the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department still requires its deputies. The first 2 years, their job is to work the jails. They do nothing but work the jails. So that's what turns out on the street.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I was saying this when I talked about it before. What's cool about this movie, I think it's going to be one of those films like American Graffiti or Dazed and Confused, where you look back and, wow, everybody in this movie became a big deal, because Ezra Miller is in it, and Michael Angarano, and...
All these good young actors.
All these young actors sort of on the cusp, that are in this film.
At the same time.
Plus you've got Billy Crudup playing... Dr. Zimbardo, and you've got Nelson Ellis, who was in Get On Up and True Blood, playing an actual ex-con who keeps trying to tell them they have to stop the experiment.
No, he goes along with it too.
For a few days.
True, he's right. No, you're doing it right.
Yeah, this is exactly how it works. Oh, yeah, no, sorry. It's the doctor's girlfriend who's played by Olivia Thirlby who's like, no, you got to pull the plug on this. This is insane.
Right.
Yeah, so definitely, I think it is, it's in limited release, but it's starting to pop up on demand on certain cable systems. So if you can get it from whoever your provider is, check it out. It's really great.
I would be a guard.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Because it's 1971, everybody's being all anti-establishment. Nobody volunteers to be a guard. And yet, even these people who didn't want to be guards, you know, take on that mindset very quickly.
So in case I ever sign up for this experiment, I should be a guard.
You should be a guard. Okay.
Yeah, be a guard. Right. That's what I would want to be. I would want to be the guard. Or what I would really want to be is the evil opera-loving warden. Like James Gandolfini in that Robert Redford movie.
Oh, right. What was that? The Castle.
It's always the bad people who listen to the opera.
And it's always one of a couple operas. Like, you know, it's either Norma or maybe the flower duet from Lakme. That's about it. That's your
sign of evil. Oh, you know what I loved? We didn't talk about this.
What's that?
Mission Impossible. I loved the use of Turandot.
Turandot.
there's a variety of ways
you say
people,
the T, right?
Well, some people say the T, some people don't say the T. Okay. Some people say the A, and some people say the O. And it's, I mean, I'm sure there's someone out there who claims to be an expert who claims to know the specific exact way to pronounce it, but there seem to be a variety of ways to say it.
No,
but
what I
love about that use of that in Mission Impossible is, A, it makes opera seem as exciting as it actually is, and B,
if you're running around backstage chasing assassins.
It has sort of a nice, I'm most likely maybe not intentional, mm-hmm. but that opera is about, you know, a woman who sort of like a prince and a princess, and they're always sort of like putting each other up to the test, you know.
And, oh, kind of, I see.
And that's sort of a cool sort of parallel to the way Tom Cruise and Rebecca Ferguson are behaving toward each other in the film. I'm sure it wasn't. I mean, I'm not so sure it wasn't intentional.
It may well have been.
It's a cool use of opera and film that does not involve someone being ultimate evil. You know, because that's always the way it works.
I do like assassination attempts like at big concert halls. You know, both versions of The Man Who Knew Too Much have that. And then Foul Play, of course, has that whole attempt to assassinate the Pope during a production of The Mikado. That's a very fun segment. A sequence of the film, I like it a lot. All right, Joelle, what's your DVD pick?
Can I do two real quick?
Sure.
One real quick. The Tig, I'll just do, because if you're probably on Netflix, maybe you know this already. The Tig Notaro, and it seems like it's trending, so maybe you've already seen it, but it's really good. It's about Tig Notaro's year after her stand-up at Largo in Los Angeles about the breast cancer.
Right.
She had just been diagnosed with breast cancer. It follows her in a year. And talk about someone whose head doesn't get turned by fame blowing up. So again, because she's like low-key or she's grounded like that doesn't, you know, and I guess she doesn't blow up to like Michael Jackson's level, but nonetheless.
It's really good. We saw it opening night of Outcast.
Yeah, loved it.
Now streaming on Netflix.
Because when I think of Linoleum Knife, I think of The Identical, which I did try on your recommendation. I tried what I couldn't get in. I think my Identical right now is Grace of Monaco, which is now streaming on Netflix.
Oh,
it's not as so. I've watched it twice.
We didn't even talk about that on the show. We sat down and watched it on Lifetime, and we were like,
the speech that she gives at the end, Nicole Kidman as Grace Kelly, or Princess Grace at the end. If you get to the end, she gives this speech that you just go, there is no way that Grace Kelly Princess Grace gave a speech to like Monaco dignitaries and talked about love.
No.
There is no way. So that's my current Identical.
That's a good choice. I have still never dared to watch Diana.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that one.
Which yet. I hear is a real doozy, but okay. Interesting choices. Dave?
This is a film that is unavailable on DVD. But it is available on YouTube through a Korean film channel with English subtitles. It's in its entirety.
Okay.
So it is of my... I am of the belief that it is, legal to watch it.
Sure.
Without
if we can't get it elsewhere, then yes.
It is impossible to get. I don't think it's ever been released in the United States on DVD.
Okay.
But it's Hong Sang-soo's 1996 directorial debut, The Day a Pig Fell into a Well. There is no pig. There is no well. It is a. It's a. It's a.
Is there a pigeon on a branch?
It's a metaphorical. It's a metaphorical title, and what it is it's about these four people, who are all sort of in different circumstances, but who are all sort of using each other and playing each other, but not in any sort of grand
manipulative
way. More like an everyday sort of. You know, you think you're an everyday, average, okay person, but you're really being sort of a jerk to this guy over here.
Hmm.
For your own selfishness. For your own selfish desires. So you've got men and women involved in user-style relationships mm-hmm. that are sometimes adulterous. Making double time with someone over here and someone over there. And Hong's directorial style is very much about these bland, mundane interiors where people are sort of stuck, you know, apartments and little, you know, ticket offices where someone works. Yeah, they're not. It's not long, slow cinema that I have become stereotypically associated with in terms of liking.
Oh, I'd say you earned that.
This is a sort of exploration of the ugly interiors of people's lives and therefore visually reflected by the not especially attractive interiors of their real lives.
Okay.
It's an amazing film. Sort of ugly realism, and I wholeheartedly recommend that you watch The Day a Pig Fell into a Well.
Okay.
Family movie night.
Get the kids. My pick actually is Unfriended is out this week, and I think that what you need to do is either get the DVD or get it streaming online and watch it on your laptop.
Yeah, watch it on your laptop.
I think that provides a viewing experience that really is the ideal for this movie. Because then that way you can sort of pretend that it's all unfolding in front of you on your computer, which is how the whole movie is shot. The whole film, you know, there's like a menu bar at the top of the screen. It's all taking place in one person's computer. And so in the same way that, you know, I got a charge out of seeing Billy Wilder's 1-2-3 in East Berlin or watching The Poseidon Adventure on a cruise ship in December with Ernest Borgnine, I think watching Unfriended on a laptop is a next level kind of participatory movie experience that will make that movie special.
So we don't really have time for letters today. We've had 7 films. Eight that we've discussed.
Well, I do want to acknowledge real quick, we had an email from Dave Kittredge. I got a message on Facebook from your art film bro, Matt Severson. Somebody else on the Facebook page pointed it out. I made a mistake a couple of weeks ago when I was recommending Seconds on DVD. I said the cinematographer was Louis John Carlino. He's actually the screenwriter. I meant to say that the cinematographer was the great James Wong Howe. In my defense, we recorded that show during Outfest. I was exhausted. It's a miracle that I didn't say that the cinematographer was Jennifer Love Hewitt. So, my bad. Thank you to everybody who caught it. You should still see Seconds. It's great.
One of the conversations that Matt and I had post-Phoenix at the Non-Hut. If you ever go to the Royal Theater in the Lemley Royal in West Los Angeles and you're looking for something to eat before or after...
There's a lot of choices there.
Your movie, there are not a lot of choices.
Well, there's churros.
Well, but that's not a meal.
And there's
you could get in your car and go over to Sawtelle where there are a lot of choices.
True, yes.
But if you're just on foot,
okay,
go to the Non-Hut because it's like a half a block away. They have really nice food there. They make their own bread. It's pretty good. But one of the conversations we had there at the Non-Hut was that
Matt, N-A-A-N.
Yeah. That non.
Yes.
Yeah. People know what naan is. N-A-A-N. It's bread. You know. Flat bread. Anyway. He just watched Glitter and,
for the first time?
And Windows for the first
time.
Oh,
my God. Oh, man.
I almost want to have him on as a guest.
To talk about Glitter and Windows?
Just to talk about those two films.
Wow.
Because he was shaken by both of them in different ways.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, Windows is something. That's a piece
I'm
of work.
I'm writing down Windows.
Windows is Cruising for Ladies. Huh? It came out the same year, and it is as lesbophobic as Cruising is... potentially, depending on how you read of it, homophobic. Elizabeth Ashley plays a woman who is obsessed with the raw sexual charisma of Talia Shire.
That's right.
And decides that she's going to...
Gotta get some.
Hire men to torment Talia Shire so that Talia will come running into her arms. It's the one film directed by the great cinematographer Gordon Willis.
I think you're underselling the word torment here.
Well, they get rapey.
They rape her.
Not all. I think there are one of them. I think
she
mugs
raped.
Her.
She Talia does get Shire raped. Is raped.
Yeah, it's a sick piece of business.
It's
this movie.
Sick garbage movie. And the lesbian hires the rapist to rape the woman so that she will run into the arms of Elizabeth Ashley.
Sure.
It's
horrifying.
Such a horrible, awful film, and yet. Bizarrely watchable in that ugly, terrible, how did this ever get
made?
Yeah,
I can't believe I'm watching this and that anybody saw Dailies and thought, oh yes, this is working.
Yeah, we're happy we made this film. It's truly vile.
It's despicable. Glitter came up in conversation recently because we had the secret screening that we had on the last day of Outfest was the upcoming film I Am Michael with James Franco and Zachary Quinto. And the director's name... is Justin Kelly. So, of course, the first thing that pops into my mind is from Justin to Kelly, because I'm human. And it reminded me of how when Stephen Ribello and I did our... It's funny, this has been popping up. I think it was exactly like five years ago, but... we did a series at the American Cinematheque called So Bad They're Brilliant, and we closed out with a double feature of Glitter and From Justin to Kelly, which the person handling prints at Fox said, neither of these films have ever been shown in repertory before. So we were ahead of the curve there.
Yeah, Glitter is a bad movie that you can watch and understand its badness and enjoy yourself. Windows is a movie that is a bad movie that you watch and you think,
I need a Silkwood shower.
Why did I just see this?
Yeah.
And who was thinking this was
a good idea?
Valuable at the time. It sank like a stone. It's not like it was a hit or anything.
Yeah, no.
But just ghastly. But if you're curious about that kind of thing,
in the historical context of awful movies about lesbians or women in general, you know, it attention must be paid.
Yeah,
I feel a little bit like you were talking about Windows with Showgirls, with a scene at the end where the Elizabeth Berkley's best friend is raped at a friend point. It's like that movie is so wonderful and it's just cluelessness and so awful. And then there's that. It's like, and it's about nothing, and it's just violence, and it's just...
This is an argument that Dave White and I have been having for the last
20 years. Yeah.
Because I'm with your friend on that one. Yeah. I think that the movie has this sort of... And Gina Gershon agrees with me, that it has this sort of... There's a kind of weird sort of otherworldly campiness to it. Or if not, if you don't want to, if you object to the word camp in this context, you know, that this odd sense of stylization, and then suddenly it becomes Spetters. Like it becomes a different kind of Paul Verhoeven movie for that sequence, and it's jarring. Dave defends its presence.
I don't defend rape.
No, but I mean, its presence in the film.
I defend the choice to include that scene in the film because... It is in keeping with other earlier Paul Verhoeven films. And I believe that all of... And I've said this on the show so many times. I believe Showgirls is a sort of deranged art film about bad people doing bad things to each other nonstop for the sake of their own, you know, getting what they need to get. And
it's a metaphor for show business.
And in that context, the rape is... understandable dramatically as something that someone would do to someone.
Right, but I think it's the manner of presentation as opposed to the manner of presentation of everything else in the movie.
I think you can say that the tone of that scene is uglier than the tone of everything else.
Yes.
But at the same time, it's meant to be a climactic moment of ugliness.
No, clearly. But I think the movie shifts gears and then shifts back again, because even like Nomi's big revenge scene after that.
Oh my gosh, she goes like ninja.
Yeah. In keeping with the rest of the film sort of, you know, broadly portrayed sense of reality. And that rape scene is very ugly,
yeah,
real.
No. Can I? Is, yeah, no, it is.
And so that's my thing. It's not that the rape itself doesn't fit the rest of the movie. It's the way that it's filmed and shot and included, as opposed to everything else that came before it and after it. It seems like a jarring shift in tone.
I have a whole other view about Showgirls than the dominant.
I think the world will catch up with you. You are not alone on that one. You and Jacques Rivette and other folks.
Right.
Are
Team Jacques Rivette.
Yeah.
Come on, that team right there.
All right. Joelle, where can people find you online?
JoelleRyan.com. You can find the podcast, Facebook, Joelle Ryan Thing. Podbean, if Google Joelle Ryan Thing. It's also on Stitcher now, iTunes, maybe not after the 5 minutes. I've had reports it's cutting out after 5 minutes on some players. I'm trying to fix it, but it's on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher.
Cool. I will post links on our Facebook page, of course. Thank you so much for being here.
Twitter? Yes. At Joelle Ryan.
JoelleRyan.
Thank you so much, guys.
No, our pleasure.
I have two announcements to make.
Oh, please do.
Since quitting my job at Movies.com at the end of May, people have been coming over to me on Facebook and Twitter and saying, hey, I'm glad I found you again. I don't see any reviews on Movies.com. What's happening? And I always say, I'm now writing reviews for myself at linoleum-knife.com. And while that is the case, and while that will continue for the entire month of August, coming up, this is now August 2nd, we're beginning this show, there you will see no written anything from me on linoleum-knife.com for the rest of the month, for the entire month of August, because I am devoting all of my attention to finishing the book that I have spent the summer working on.
Nice.
I will be using my time in August to write everything that isn't a film review. I'll still see the movies that we need to see, mm-hmm. to talk about them here, to talk about them on the radio, but I will not be writing anything for the site until August, so don't flip out or be like, how come I don't see a review of whatever movie? Well, the reason is because I'm writing a book.
Yes. Dave's second book, it's a collection of essays called Keep It Heavy, Man.
Yes.
Which hopefully at the end of August you'll have done.
And not hopefully, I will.
All right.
I'm telling you right now. And I am telling you.
I believe in you.
The other thing is, this is incredibly important. This is the most important thing you're going to hear all day. Linoleum Knife now is on Instagram.
Correct.
We have an Instagram account.
Last week I created the account during the show, but now Dave is filling it with things.
It is exactly 3 days old, this Instagram account. I have posted 4 vital photographs that you need to look at and like and comment on and all that stupid stuff that you do on Instagram.
Share.
We have 69 followers after 4 days. That's right. We want more than that, though.
Yes, we do.
We don't want to hold on. We don't want to hold at 69 followers.
No. Get us to 666.
The Linoleum Knife Instagram account is going to be devoted to showing you what happens while we are doing our jobs.
Yes.
That's basically it. You're going to see us doing movie-related stuff. Stuff related to this podcast, it's going to be very exciting for you.
Riveting.
And so, yeah. Okay, so on Instagram, we are, just like on Twitter and just like on Facebook, we are Linoleum Cast.
Actually, not on Facebook, we're Linoleum Knife Podcast.
Whatever.
On Twitter and Instagram, we are Linoleum Cast.
Linoleum Cast. So go find us there. And I'm the one sort of running the show on Instagram. So
I have it in my phone now. I will try and add stuff too when I can.
Yeah.
when I'm going to things. I should have taken pictures at the Adakoff, because now apparently that's not going to be a thing anymore.
And when Alonzo takes a picture, it will be subject to my approval.
We'll see about that. All right, so we're running a little long, so I won't do my usual litany of stuff to go check out. But of course, we do thank Blue for our wonderful theme music, and we want to thank Joel Ryan for being our great guest this week. It's been lovely to have you here.
Thank you.
And just a reminder that you can purchase the Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife Extra episodes. PayPal us $1.99 at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com, and let us know where you want those sent. Our most recent one is for What's Up Doc. We have also recently recorded them for Two for the Road and the Poseidon Adventure and Clue and the Apple and Josie and the Pussycats. Do you want to talk about what our next one's going to be? Should we let that cat out of the bag or not yet?
No, not yet, because okay. It's not going to happen until like mid-September.
Right. Yeah. So. And not until I come back from the Venice Film Festival, where I'm going to the Venice Film Festival. Anyway, so we'll tell you about that as it comes closer, and we have a couple more that we're planning to do before the end of the year. In addition, as well as, of course, our annual Christmas one, which we'll tell you about that as we get closer. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
Goodbye.